Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of Podcasts. I am Stephen Houseman, and I'm your host for today's interview, and I'm speaking today with Paul Barba. Dr. Barba is an assistant professor of history at Bucknell University and is the author of the new book, Country of the Cursed and the Driven, Slavery and the Texas Borderlands, which came out with the University of Nebraska Press in 2022, and I'm very pleased to say, just won both the W. Turrentine Jackson Prize and the David J. Weber Prize from the Western History Association. Welcome to the New Books Network, Paul, and congratulations on all the awards.
Hey, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your audience.
Why don't we just start, as we always do on the New Books Network, by hearing a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your background and tell us in particular how you became interested in history.
All right. Well, first I'll say that I'm recovering from a cold right now, pretty nasty cold, so my voice may not be too pleasant to listen to. But in terms of my background, it's pretty boring as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that there's a whole lot to talk about. I come from a rather large Mexican-American family from Southern California, grew up in the San Fernando Valley. And I think in terms of my broader development as someone invested in, interested in history, you know, if you're anybody who's from Southern California or Los Angeles, you're probably aware that it's an extremely diverse place, racially, ethnically, culturally, also in terms of class, obviously. But it's also rather segregated. And I experienced this quite a bit firsthand growing up there in the 90s and early 2000s, especially in the context of schooling. And, you know, I went to these programs that were definitely challenging, and I'm grateful for being in these. They're called magnet programs. But even within these schools, you have a lot of diversity, and yet they're still extremely segregated. And so, you know, witnessing the uneven ways that police and security would interact with student populations, and just seeing these iniquities in play on a day-to-day basis, was always very apparent to me. And so trying to understand that world, trying to understand those power dynamics have driven me quite a bit. And I didn't intend to go into history when I went to college at the University of California, Santa Barbara, but I've always appreciated history as a lens for understanding society today and the way people behave and interpret their reality. So anyhow, went to UC Santa Barbara, took some great classes. I majored in history eventually once I started doing a lot of the hands-on stuff and, you know, digging through documents on my own, looking at collections and realizing that as a 20-year-old or 21-year-old, whatever, you do have some power in crafting those narratives. And I think that was enlightening, but it was also very empowering to see that, to witness that, and to appreciate that historical knowledge isn't something that's simply fixed, but, you know, is a matter of of interpretation, rigorous interpretation. So, did that, minored in Black Studies. Those classes really helped me to contextualize what I was learning in history. And then somehow slipped into graduate school also at UC Santa Barbara. Didn't know what I was doing. I had no connection to grad school. You know, family members had gone to undergrad like me, but I didn't know what I was in for, and so I came in with no funding. Foolishly went in without funding and kind of just meandered for some time. And anyhow, I made it through, and now I'm at Bucknell in Central Pennsylvania. So. I can't complain.
The story that you told a minute ago is one that I hear a lot from historians, where growing up, they see the world around them, you know, kind of shaped a particular way, and they're perceiving it in a particular way. And this question of why is the world like this? Why is my life like this? Why are the people that are around me these particular people? This is something that I hear, or a frame that I hear a lot from historians reflecting on sort of what drove them to get into this field. And it sounds like you had a similar experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I really appreciate about the field of history is that I think at its heart, at its core, it's a philosophical endeavor, right? It's a reflection on human experience. And so we're tempted to take these teleological approaches where we want to know how we got to where we are today. And so we're always looking back to figure out, you know, that narrative, that story. But at the same time, by casting a wide net, by looking at people from many different contexts, you begin to appreciate a lot of the nuance of human experience, and also to think beyond the paradigms of today. So on the one hand, although like there's this impulse that I definitely rode into the field of understanding how we got to where we're at, I think the more that I've been in it, the more I've been able to appreciate that like we don't have to be here. We can move on to other things, because humans have done it in different ways for a long time.
And speaking of people in different contexts, I'm curious what brought you to the topic of this book. Why Texas, and why in particular this question of slavery in Texas in the period of time that you cover here?
Yeah, another not interesting story. But, you know, I, as I said, I barely slipped into graduate school. My initial advisor, he got really ill, so he wasn't around for the first couple of years, and I more or less just floated through my coursework, and I was somewhat aimless. Eventually, I teamed up with my mentor, Paul Spickard. He called me the Mowgli of the department. He said, because I look like Mowgli, but also because I was just raised by the wolves, right? Nobody was there to take care of me. Anyhow, I went in thinking that I was going to do a post-Civil War project, really fascinated with Reconstruction era in the United States as an undergrad. And so I came in hoping to do that. And I read this book by Leslie Schwamm, Emancipation's Diaspora, and it's on Reconstruction in the Upper Midwest. And I found it super fascinating as a way to kind of take us into new questions and new concerns relative to the period of Reconstruction. And so I thought, you know what, I want to keep moving west. I want to see if I can take the story of the post-Civil War United States out west. And so I thought, you know what, I'm in California. It'd probably be easy to do research on California in this period. I took the idea to a professor, and I was excited about it. And she shot me down and said, oh, there's nothing to be done on that topic. So I ended up thinking, all right, well, if that's not going to work, and she was actually incorrect about that, as much work has come out recently on Reconstruction in the in California, in the far west. But anyhow, I kept looking for other possible case studies, if you will, and I knew Texas had some unique demographics during this period. And so I started exploring Texas during Reconstruction. And as I did a lot of this preliminary research, I realized I didn't know enough about the period before, right? Especially if I'm concerned about slavery and the legacies of slavery, I probably should get a better sense of what was going on prior to the Civil War if I'm going to be able to speak authoritatively about Reconstruction. And so I just started going backwards. And as historians tend to do, once you start going back in time, like, you just keep going back, right, further and further. And that's kind of what I did in my book, to the point where I guess my narrative in chapter one starts off in, like, you know, the beginning of the 16th century. So, yeah, that's pretty much how I got to. I realized that no one had written a book that had fully, you know, or sought to fully bring together all of these narratives of the different groups of people who would come to inhabit Texas by the mid-19th century. And so I thought, you know what, let's see if I can take a stab at it.
And not only do you go further and further back in time, but just hearing you tell that story, I was laughing a little bit over here, because you actually end the book at pretty much the time when you intended to start off the book with the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, you just said a second ago that you know you're going further and further back in time in this book, and I want to get into some of the details of that history. But I'm wondering if, just to begin, you can give us maybe just a bit of an overview of Texas during the time period that you're covering, the 18th in kind of most of the 19th century. And I guess to maybe narrow this question down a bit, how and why were slavery and unfreedom, why were they so central to this place's history and the experience of the people who lived there?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You're asking me to distill 320 pages into a few remarks, but I appreciate it. I think the short answer is colonialism, right? The convergence of colonialisms, if you will, and the extent to which violence undergirds these colonial systems. They all seem to come together in Texas. And I don't know that Texas is entirely unique in that way, but what's especially significant about Texas is that the geopolitics for centuries don't really allow for a single state to operate with a mandate or to operate as, you know, a hegemonic structure. And so I characterize Texas as a series of borderlands, right? In these borderlands, which aren't ruled necessarily by any one group, but are continually contested by one another, the state has only limited influence. And instead, you have smaller communities that are usually structured by family, day-to-day concerns, other social mechanisms that are relatively informal, and these and this borderlands context, I mean, for a number of reasons, but it essentially just fosters violent interactions. And it's important to keep in mind that there is a broader context to what's happening here, right? It's all just, for whatever reason, coming together in this geographic region that eventually is known as Texas. And so slavery is a tradition that's imported by Spaniards, right, by Iberians. And this is what I track in the first chapter, to give you a sense of how important slavery is for the expansion of Spanish empire. And, you know, eventually Spanish colonists make their way to this broader Texas region. But in doing so, they initiate a larger system of captivity, of capturing people, of trafficking in people. And it becomes an important mechanism for dominion, for controlling resources, for controlling populations, or asserting a measure of power in this relatively unstable place. And so in the 19th century, by the time Anglo-American colonists make their way to Texas, they're bringing with them their own tradition of slavery or traditions of slavery. And they find a relatively comfortable place in Texas because people have been enslaving each other for so long at that point.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that early Spanish history, because the main narrative of the book picks up kind of in the early 18th century, but you also explain, as you said a second ago, that these practices of slavery and of captivity, you know, at that moment in the 18th century, they're rooted in these much deeper practices that are emerging from Spanish colonization of the region. So what did slavery and captivity look like under sort of 16th and 17th century Spanish, the Spanish regime, and how do Spanish practices of slavery, how do they shape this very early Texas borderlands region?
Yeah, so I think, you know, on the one hand, you have the so-called black legend of Spanish conquest, right? The brutality of Spaniards first conquering the Caribbean and then leapfrogging into the mainland, Mexico, and then spreading outward from there. I think to an extent, we have to appreciate that violence and how they're enslaving local populations, indigenous populations, in order to exploit, to profit, to get rich quick. And what that ends up doing is setting off a series of wars in the interior, right? And by the 1540s, you have the so-called Chichimeca Wars, which are the rather nomadic people who are resisting this violence actively, and they're doing a rather effective job of undermining the Spanish colonial project. But what it effectively does is give these Spanish colonists rhetorical ammunition for further conquests, right? Because they are resisting the Christian, you know, what they call Christianization. They see them as unworthy of a gentle response. And so, you know, it's one of those things where the brutality of Spanish colonization is always there, but you do have religious figures, religious institutions that are trying to, quote unquote, save these people. And so there's that tension that continues throughout the 16th century into the 17th century, and definitely where I start my narrative, or start the crux of my narrative in the 18th century. But the cycles of violence that Spanish colonists engulf indigenous populations in during the 16th century will continue to replicate themselves over and over again as the Spanish frontier moves northward. Even though you have, by the middle part of the 16th century, Spanish authorities who are questioning whether or not the enslavement of native people is appropriate, because, you know, you have to at least give them a chance to become Christians before you brutalize them. And so many of these Spanish colonists are able to justify what they're doing by saying, look, they're resisting us, and so the only, you know, proper response is to enslave them, to Christianize them through bondage. And so that's part of the story that you have, and I think that's extremely important context for understanding Spanish perceptions of what they're doing in Texas as this broader colonizing force. But you also have the mass importation of African people, right? And this happened, it almost coincides with the conquest of Mexico in the early part of the 16th century. So, and to be honest, I think this literature is only starting to really flower as we begin to appreciate the number of enslaved black people in central Mexico and how they've influenced the history, but also society, culture, economic systems, etc. And you have these two systems of slavery, right? The enslavement of local indigenous people, but also the importation of African captives. And both exist side by side, but eventually they come together again in these different regions on the frontier, on the northern frontier of Mexico and in Texas. I try to track that as best as I can, although the documentary record is a little bit muted when it comes to both of those systems at the same, you know, periods of time. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is anything else in terms of that early period? I think that
No. I think that covered it well. And I had another question about this early period. And one of the things that I thought you did remarkably well in this book is that this is not just a top-down story. It's not an abstract story either. That you really root a lot of the narrative that you tell in the experience, as much as is possible, in the experience of people who are experiencing this captivity. And you said something interesting early in the book, sort of early, I believe this is in chapter two, you're talking about Spain is beginning to colonize Texas in the kind of middle decades of the 18th century. And you write that slavery tied disparate people together really through the brutality of this system. And I'm wondering how this was the case and kind of what you meant by this. And then just in a kind of a broader sense, what were some of the effects of slaving and the what was the experience of slavery like for individuals in this early period?
Yeah, I think when we're looking at the early 18th century, so Spanish missionaries try to get a foothold in Texas during the late 17th century. Missionaries venture out to Tocado territory, which is basically modern day East Texas, and they have some flashes of potential, if you will, but they bring soldiers with them, and the soldiers are invested in exploiting the local population, so they begin to abuse some of the local women, and they're quickly expelled. And it's not until French colonists begin to build in this lower Mississippi Valley region that Spanish officials are like, oh, wow, we need to make sure that we have something established in this Texas region. So they send colonists out there in the 17 teens. And during this period, it seems unlikely that they're going to have any success because they have this reputation for enslaving locals. And many of the local people who are residing in like this San Antonio region, they're aware of this. Like they know that Spaniards aren't to be trusted. And even though there may be a generation or two away from or distant from that real heavy slaving period, in the northern region of like Nuevo León, for instance, they still understand that this is a dangerous population, and they should tread carefully if they're going to be collaborating with them. In any case, these Spanish authorities are able to convince the local populations that they'd be able to help them, right? And so it's ironic because of the brutality of the Spanish regime that local people would accept them and actually forge an alliance with them. But it only makes sense in the context of changing geopolitics within indigenous Texas at the time. And at the time, we see somewhat of a rise of Eastern Apache people who are, for a number of reasons, asserting themselves definitely in the more western and northern parts of Texas, but even toward the eastern parts. And this may have something to do with the budding French presence in the east in Louisiana. But either way, they're becoming more dominant and they're starting to encroach upon the homelands of these native people in like the San Antonio region of Texas. And so when Spaniards come, they promise the locals, they say, we will defend you. We will, you know, help you out in terms of providing food and supplies, right? And this is where the missions become important in that regard, because they're essentially just offering tribute to these local people, and they'll also defend them. And so right away, when they colonize or they establish these small communities in San Antonio, they begin to raid these Apache communities. And it's almost like instantaneously that they're enslaving Apaches and bringing them back to their communities in San Antonio. And surprisingly, many of these local indigenous people, like Payayas, for instance, they are on board with this program, right? And they accept the violence of Spaniards to defend them against this Apache encroachment, or at least what they perceive as Apache encroachment. And so you have there, you know, one of the ways in which these people are coming together through the enslavement of one another, and it just, you know, it works. And I guess one other thing I'd add to that question is diplomacy. And Juliana Barr has done a wonderful job of spelling this out in her book from already over a decade ago. But she talks about how captives were instrumental for facilitating diplomacy, right? So if you can capture somebody from another community, you extract as much information and intel from them as possible, and then send them off to try to forge some sort of agreement between these communities, you were in pretty good shape, at least until they went back and said, oh, well, they haven't released all of their captives, and so we should continue to fight. In any case, you know, it's undeniable that this slaving violence is prominent in all of the relations between the communities in Texas during the first half of the 18th century.
And it's around the same time that another group begins to gain power in this region, and that's, of course, the Comanche. Can you tell us a bit about their history in the Texas Borderlands region and how, with them as well, slavery is central to their ascendancy during this era?
Yes, Comanches arrive, as far as the documentary record can be trusted, arrive in the broader Texas region during the 1740s. We know at least as early as the 1740s, they are beginning to emerge as a significant geopolitical force. And they do so as slave raiders against Apache people. So it's around that same time that Apaches start looking to Spaniards for assistance, because they're more concerned about their Comanche enemies than they are about their Spanish enemies. Although they are still, you know, they're put in a terrible position where, you know, no decision is going to be really a good decision. But they're more worried about this Comanche onslaught than they are about Spanish violence, which is relatively weak when you compare it to what Comanches are doing. In any case, Comanches emerge more or less from the New Mexico sphere, and I say that in terms of just the documentary record, right? They obviously have their own world that exists independent of it, but we see a lot of their activities through the lenses of these Spanish officials and observers. And what's important to keep in mind is that you have, throughout the 17th century, this trickle, if you will, or maybe it's more than a trickle, but you have the spread of horses throughout the Southern Plains, or, you know, the American West, United States, what would eventually be the United States West, and this. The horse is transformative for a lot of people who are able to integrate it effectively within their communities. And Comanches, by the end of the 17th century, have, and we're not exactly sure how, you know, you can look to Comanche oral tradition for some details, but they have made horse technology one of the key fulcrums of their existence, their social existence, their military prowess, their economic prowess. And perhaps the Pueblo Revolt from 1680 became a catalyst for the proliferation of horses among their community. But what we do know, again, is that they have adopted horses by the end of the 17th century, and now they're using that horse technology to expand their economic influence and their geopolitical influence. So in New Mexico, pretty much from day one, around 1600, you have a slaving market that's established by Spaniards, and they do this more effectively than they do in the Texas context. You know, Juan de Oñate, he pretty much from day one makes it clear that conquest through brutality and enslavement is going to be a part of the Spanish regime. And then later governors would continue enslaving locals, purchasing locals, exploiting them within New Mexico through the obrajes, the workshops, and other things. They're also sending enslaved people south to the heart of Mexico, to various mining communities, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that you have a relatively vibrant slaving market in New Mexico, and Comanches tap into it, and they become one of the prominent slave traders of the region. They are almost immediately, at least in the documentary record, enslaving Apache communities in the New Mexico sphere. And as these Apache communities flee and head south and eastward, Comanches follow them. And by the 1740s, they follow them all the way to Texas, until it becomes clear that this is going to create a new geopolitical crisis in the Texas sphere by the late 1750s.
And earlier you touched on the idea of kinship as being really important to understanding slaving practices in the 18th century Texas borderlands. I'm wondering if you can explain this concept a bit and maybe talk a bit about how different forms of this idea of kinship, how it acted as a means of both exploitation and of adaptation to what is really a pretty violent world in 18th century Texas.
Well, if you recall my point about Texas being borderlands, where the state has only limited influence, instead we see how family becomes an important mechanism of social control, right? Of social organization, but definitely control and even dominion building. Family is one of the ways in which Spanish colonists are able to evade the dictates of the far-off state, right? They don't have to worry about violating Spanish law, which doesn't have that much direct influence on their lives, but they don't have to worry about it because they are enslaving these people and integrating them into their family as their godchildren. I mean, it's typically how it emerges in the record, where these soldiers will go out, raid a community, bring people back to their community, and then take them to the local church, baptize them, and how they become bound to their household. And you'll see this through the baptismal records, but you also see traces of it in just the county records, if you will. I mean, they're not county records, but the governmental records of how these enslaved people, usually children, usually women, they become bound to this Christian household, and they're not allowed to leave because it would be a violation of their enslavers' Christian duties to return them to their heathen origins. But I think on a practical level, and I try to keep that in mind, the Spanish colonies are really isolated. Like it's difficult for them to just get by because of how alone they are on the frontier. And so they have to rely on local markets, right, with indigenous people, and they're extremely short on labor. So you have these slave raids serving as opportunities to procure laborers for themselves, just to kind of just, you know, meek out a basic existence, you know, per their own paradigm. But the family is useful because they can surveil them easily. They have this ideological cover. It fits within their broader patriarchal framework, and in some cases, you know, it's an avenue toward reproductive labor, right, where they're sexually exploiting these captive people and that allows them to create new people for their communities. And actually, the point about reproductive labor is important for thinking about Comanche communities as they are integrating enslaved people. And this doesn't happen immediately, at least it doesn't seem that way from documentary evidence. But by the end of the 18th century and certainly into the 19th century, as women are more readily integrated into Comanche communities and made into wives, as the anthropological literature would say, they are exploiting them for their reproductive labor. And you know, this is in the face of disease, mass disease, that is, you know, epidemics that are wiping out a lot of their population. So it's important to integrate these people in order to sustain their population levels, at least to a degree. But again, the family is kind of the governing unit of society. It's how they function. It's how they're brought together. And so it just kind of makes sense. It's the easiest way to integrate these people on a very practical level. Although, you know, the flip side is that it becomes ideologically convenient because, oh, these are my family now. Doesn't matter that I'm exploiting them, I'm violating them, I'm abusing them, but because they're considered family, you know, they fit within their societies.
And this already very complex and very crowded region, it changes yet again in the early 19th century as you begin to see the colonization, maybe the recolonization of Texas by Anglos in this period. So how does this also alter the geopolitics of this borderlands? And in particular, how is it changing the nature of slavery in the region?
Anglo-Americans start to arrive in the early 19th century, slowly. You know, usually traders are those who are making their way out west to Texas. But then by the 1820s, you have these projects of colonization that are sanctioned by the state. But it's worth keeping in mind that that Anglo colonization only occurs or is only entertained by the Spanish government at first, and then the Mexican government, because it happens as they're transitioning from Spanish rule to Mexican rule. It only occurs because of indigenous people and how they're resisting Euro-American colonialism. And the frontier, the northern frontier of Mexico, is constantly giving Spanish authorities and then Mexican authorities headaches, right? They don't know how to people this region and how to limit the influence of these indigenous communities. So when Moses Austin and many others, actually, he wasn't the first, but there are many folks who are reaching out to the Spanish government for these colonial projects. But when Moses Austin says, look, I can bring families, I can bring Euro-American, civilized would be the word that they use, but I can bring Euro-American families out to this region to populate it and help you stifle this indigenous presence. Spanish authorities are like, you know what, this isn't a bad idea, because they had been trying to do this for a century, right? And they had come up with all these schemes, and really none of them had been successful. But Austin is connected well enough, and he gained some traction among the authorities, but then he dies. So his son, Stephen F. Austin, takes up his mantle and continues this effort, which does get approval by Mexican authorities. And so when they arrive, it's not inappropriate to consider them part of Hispanic colonialism. Like it's part of that regime, and Austin himself tries his best to make that a reality, in the sense that he learns Spanish. He encourages his colonists to learn Spanish. He says that he's going to become Catholic and that other people should also become Catholic. It's not successful in that regard, as we know, in the end. But even if we look at this early period in the 20s and into the 30s, Anglo colonists are embracing this Spanish model or Hispanic model of attacking, raiding, conquering native people. And they do this in conjunction, in some cases, with the Mexican locals. So in that regard, the presence of Anglo colonists early on, it helps to facilitate Hispanic colonization or colonialism. But the other part of Anglo colonization is the mass importation of African people, of Black people. And this becomes a complicated issue for both the Anglo colonists and Mexican locals, Tejanos, as they're sometimes called, as well as Mexican officials, because you have within Mexico a pretty prominent anti-slavery movement. They're not happy about the fact that Austin and his people are bringing enslaved Black people with them to Texas, and so that becomes an important wedge between the communities, or at least between officials and the Anglo colonists. But they managed to navigate this for several years. In some cases, they just ignore the concerns by the Mexican government. In other cases, they claim, again, that these Black people are just part of their family, so you don't need to worry about them as enslaved folks in the traditional sense. In any case, their numbers overwhelm the Mexican system, right? As Anglo colonization progresses from the 20s into the 30s, we're now talking about tens of thousands of people, while during the 18th century, we're only talking about thousands, maybe several thousand people across the Spanish regime in Texas. Now we're talking about tens of thousands of people, with thousands of enslaved Black people among them. And so this really concerns a lot of the officials within Mexico, and eventually this leads to the Texas Rebellion, which ushers in an entirely different age of slavery, I would argue.
And this arrival, this importation of all of these new people that you say, it overwhelms this older system. This turns what had at one point been this very contested borderlands region into, I believe you say in the book, into an extension of the American South. And, as we kind of get closer to the Civil War, as we reach the end point of your narrative, I'm wondering what is changing as Texas itself changes. What does this mean for slavery and for enslaved people and for indigenous people in the region as well?
Yeah, well, on the one hand, I don't think too much changes. You still have this ethos of martial militarism that is prominent, and you have some Tejano people who embrace it, right, who are on board with this, and this allows them to navigate the emerging Anglo system rather successfully. But anti-Blackness becomes the governing paradigm of colonialism in the Texas sphere by the late 30s and into the 40s, because it's so central to what Anglo-American colonists are trying to build in Texas. And it's undeniable that Texas, especially by the 50s, is an extension of the cotton frontier in the South, right? When we're talking about capital investments, we're talking about the movement of people from the South, from the Deep South especially, to Texas, the forced removal of enslaved Black people into Texas. I mean, the numbers really are astounding because, as I said, in the 30s, we're talking about tens of thousands of people. Now we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. So they totally overwhelm this Texas region. They're investing in cotton. You start to see many more cotton plantations. You'll see some sugar plantations as well. But everybody is moving to Texas, at least those who are moving voluntarily, to recreate themselves as cotton growers, as those who could make a fortune, if you will, and escape debt, because many of them are also escaping debt out in the East in the aftermath of these great panics of 37 and 39. But they come to Texas and they can start anew, as they believe. But they bring this anti-black regime with them, which, you know, makes blackness anathema to freedom, some would argue even social existence. And these anti-black impulses, which violence is one of the most important, they have all sorts of reverberating effects on this region. And as black people are resisting through fugitivity, through small-scale uprisings, et cetera, this only makes it more urgent for these Anglo-Americans to conquer, right? To make sure there are no weak points in this broader system, whether it be the southern border, right, the Rio Grande region, or even the northern or western parts where indigenous people are still more or less maintaining their dominion in those regions. So this also lends itself to annihilationist campaigns by the Anglo regime against native locals, including Comanches, who fight mightily to limit their influence as they're continually pushing against their own frontier at the time.
And then you end this story with the coming of the American Civil War. And in some ways, the Civil War changes quite a bit, but there's important legacies from this, you know, multi-century history that you tell here. So what does change with the end of at least legal slavery in Texas? And what are some things that stay the same? What lingers in the region even after the war itself? What are some of the legacies of this very long history of violence and of enslavement and of captivity in this region after the war itself?
Ooh, this is a tough question. I think there are a lot of opportunities to do new research in light of some of the dynamics I illuminate in my book. But I would borrow from the quote or passage that I use to title my book and also frame some of the analysis. And so the title, Country of the Cursed and the Driven, comes from a diary entry written by this Cherokee man, Elijah Hicks. And, you know, he considered himself to be a Christian man. He was anti-slavery, but he traveled as part of a broader U.S. diplomatic contingent in the mid-1840s to the broader, or he traveled across the broader borderlands region. And at one point in his diary, he comments on how everybody's enslaved. He sees, Mexican children being enslaved and exchanged between indigenous communities and also between indigenous communities and white communities. He sees Anglo children and women who are enslaved. He sees indigenous people who are enslaved, and he talks about how, you know, there's this broader context of anti-black slavery in the region. And so he calls it a country of cursed and driven people. But anyhow, as part of this entry in his diary, he's reflecting on the future. And he says that, you know, it's a melody. Slavery is a melody without a cure. And I found that sentence or that description, that commentary, to be profound as I was, you know, reflecting on the period after the Civil War because even though there is this strong federal presence that asserts itself in the latter part of 1865 and through the 60s, it's only effective to an extent to end slavery, or at least end these impulses that are driving slavery. And so I just at the end comment on how even though the military is doing its best to end slavery, at least legally, even though you have officials who go into Comancheria or at least force them to reservations, they still have enslaved people living among them. And it's almost impossible to fully divest these communities of these slaving impulses. And as we know, there are wave after wave of anti-black violence in Texas during Reconstruction and later. And I'd say that that's part of the legacy, right? These impulses of both anti-black violence and then also anti-native violence, they live on, they continue. If we look at the convict leasing system in Texas, the proliferation of prisons, I mean, that's all part of the story right here. And I don't spell it out in my book, but I think there are opportunities to see those connections transcending generations, if not even centuries. The stuff is deep, right? And it's entangled. It's tough to really extricate ourselves from these larger historical dynamics.
And then as we begin to wrap up here, I always like to get my guests to kind of flip the story around a little bit and think about, you know, there a perspective on the book from that of a reader who has read their book and is kind of thinking back on it from a remove of maybe a year or maybe a couple years. What would you hope that reader might remember or might take away from that book, thinking back on it from a couple years after reading it? Maybe another way to put that is, what's kind of one big takeaway that you hope someone would get away from this book understanding?
That's a really good question. I think one of my objectives undergirding the project, excuse me, I'm getting a little bit congested here.
It's okay, but talking a lot today.
one of the main objectives was to move away from the Texas exceptionalist mythology, right? I didn't want to get bogged down in it, and I didn't want to use it as a foil. I just didn't want it to be there, in the sense that, you know, when we think of Texas history, we think of the Alamo, we think of these brave white men going out and braving the frontier. We think about cowboys. We think about you know, that kind of exceptionalist narrative, democracy, and all that kind of stuff. I didn't want that to be a part of the book, and I also didn't want it to necessarily be the backdrop of my book. And so, if you readers may or may not discover this, but I don't use the term the Alamo a single time in my narrative, and I do that intentionally, one, to see if it was possible, but also because I don't think it needs to be one of those, you know, quintessential moments in Texas history. In fact, I think it's just part of a larger narrative that, you know, is useful for interpreting century and a half of this history. So this is moving beyond the myths. This is looking at history with all of its ugliness and thinking, you know, where do we go from here? It's all complicated. It's all deeply embedded. It's all interwoven and entangled. So these myths of a triumphalist, glorious history are not just incorrect, but they're also extremely counterproductive. I hope readers are eager to continue looking for more of this, because even though I do think Texas is rather unique, a lot of these processes are happening across the Americas, right? Across the United States, certainly, but even across the Americas broadly. And I would bet that you could find a lot of similar dynamics happening in very different regions, but still in very similar ways.
So what people, you know, may think is most important to understand Texas history actually might not be all that important at all. You're kind of pushing people to look elsewhere to understand the history of this region.
Exactly. You said it better than I did.
And then for my last question, I'm always curious about what my guests are working on next. So I know that this book has not been out for very long, but I'm curious what other projects you have sort of currently boiling away over there.
Yeah, there are a few. I've got one that's got pretty good momentum in toward the end of Country and the Curse and the Driven. I talk a little bit about Black fugitivity within Comancheria, and I've been trying to extend that story a bit, not just within Comancheria, but broadly across Native territory. And I think this is something that has been identified by many scholars, right? Thinking about how Black fugitives have often fled to Native country for refuge, but it's been underanalyzed, been underexplored. There really isn't a narrative of this. So what I've been working on is just a broad history of Black fugitivity in Native territory, and currently I'm I did more research on this, like, you know, borderlands region, Oklahoma, what will eventually become Oklahoma, even a little bit of New Mexico, that sort of thing. But now I've been spending a lot of attention, or I've been investing a lot of energy into the Southeast, thinking about South Carolina, for instance, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia. And realizing that there's quite a bit there, and so I hope to continue this story of Black fugitivity in Native country, because I think it brings to our attention a lot of issues about sovereignty, for instance, and if we consider the literature on Maronage, which does highlight the ways in which these fugitive communities sought to recreate themselves and assert their own kind of sovereignty in these regions. You know, we know that they're doing this in Native country, which is often understood in terms of sovereignty, right? They exist as autonomous nations, and the presence of these Black fugitives, although on the one hand, could be very useful in countering the colonial regimes that are planted across North America. In some ways, they become a challenge or new challenges for them. So I think I've got a compelling story here as well, and I look forward to continuing that investigation.
It sounds like a great project, although I'll point out that that's only taking you further away from California, which is, you know, where you originally wanted to start working on, and now you're suddenly in South Carolina. You're going to have to go all the way around the world to make it all the way back.
Probably, yeah. I don't expect to get to California. I think it's gone. It's long gone.
Dr. Paul Barba is an assistant professor of history at Bucknell University. His new and award-winning, multi-time over award-winning book is Country of the Cursed and the Driven, Slavery and the Texas Borderlands, which came out with the University of Nebraska Press in 2022. Thank you so much for joining me today, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good one.